This is some of the art that's falling off. The bar. Yeah. Yeah, Skelton did.
Yeah.
This is the time of set for a hearing on House Bill 1003. No, 1004. Pardon me. Anybody trying to find a seat down there? You want to hand it out? Anybody who wants to testify on House Bill 1004 who has not signed this seat, they'll pass that out again. First person who's listed to testify this morning is someone whose name I cannot read. Writing is a bad mind. What is it? Friedman. Very good. And your first name? Very good. Just take care of it.
I'd like to say, kind of parenthetically, although I think it's probably obvious, and it's not right now, it's in wording, that this does not in any sense attempt to be a legal kind of brief. I'm sure that would be the issue with it. I think it's very valid. It's far more complicated area than I, and I don't want to step into the area of lawyers in any. What I would like to say, and I do have some copies of this written, although I'm sorry that I don't believe I have sufficient for each member of the committee, but I shall be glad to leave the original review and a couple of extra copies if you'd like. So with that disclaimer from the beginning, I will just read my statement if you'd like, and then if you have additional questions, I'd be glad to ask it and to be accepted my ability. I come before you today to strongly urge your committee disapproval of House Bill 1004, which is currently before you. This bill, which seeks to remove a citizen's right to silence on questions which he deems to be of a nature which might tend to incriminate them, can be simply categorized by one phrase which is contained within the bill itself, namely clearly contrary to the public interest. In his book, The Anatomy of Liberty, the distinguished Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas stated, in speaking of the privilege against self-incrimination, once government can make men talk, and this is in quotes, ugly influences appear. The right of privacy is invaded. The dignity of the individual is assaulted. This privilege, like freedom of expression, is indispensable to the free society. In considering any new bill, it seems to me that two prime criteria must operate. One of these I've already mentioned, the public interest. The second, and equally important, is protection of the rights of the innocent. Indeed, this must be inherent in any consideration of public interest, for it is the innocent members of the general public who must be the benefactors and certainly not the victims of any law. Does this still meet these criteria? I contend that it does not. The privilege against self-incrimination, the presumption of innocence for any accused, and certainly the presumption of innocence for any not accused but merely called as witness in legal proceedings, cannot be abused, picked away at, whittled down, or destroyed without the public interest and the rights of the innocent individual suffering as a result. It is true that this bill has been introduced at the request of the Attorney General. Doubtless, he feels the frustrations that all law enforcement officials must feel at times when they believe they know the perpetrators of crime, but lack sufficient evidence to try them. but this should only make them more zealous in pursuing their duly authorized efforts to secure evidence legally without destroying the rights of those whom they are sworn first and foremost to protect and defend, the innocent, the general public. It is our right, the right of every citizen, to pursue our daily tasks lawfully, and who have a right to count our protection under the law, which are being threatened by this bill. It has always been recognized that protection of the rights of the innocent might indeed make it more difficult to prosecute and convict the guilty. But if conviction becomes too easy, the innocent will suffer far more than the guilty. Indeed, we cannot make evidence too easy to obtain, or convictions too available, without destroying the free society we supposedly seek to protect. This bill makes every witness in a grand jury hearing, as well as any called in criminal or quasi-criminal proceedings, and I admit that that last phrase baffles me, and I added parenthetically whatever that may be, because it seems to me to beg a question at least, automatically suspect if he seeks to avail himself of his constitutional privilege to remain silent. The promise of immunity, it seems to me, is meaningless without the implied presumption of liability or guilt. What would be the point of promising immunity if there were not the presumption of some guilt? And yet, the privilege against self-incrimination is supposed to be a protection for the innocent more than for the guilty. It is the innocent person's protection against being pressured into involuntarily giving testimony damaging to himself. As Congressman William Ryan of New York pointed out in his discussion of the federal version of this bill, which, as you all know, is not yet been mentioned in the Supreme Court, the constitutional privilege of the Fifth Amendment, quote, was aimed at a recurrence of the Inquisition and the Star Chamber, even if not in their stark brutality. And that's from the Congressional Record, not a citation. The immunity granted by this bill is not immunity to the innocent. Indeed, they will become the victims of pressure not only to testify, but to give testimony that will plead. And if they fail to plead, they may worry that another witness, more zealous in seeking to curry favor, will somehow contradict the first one's testimony and thus make him liable to prosecution for perjury or false swearing. For certainly, the more a witness pleads, the more he will be believed. The only ones who might conceivably benefit from the immunity offered would and could only be the guilty. Those who have truly engaged in despicable acts and who now seek to save their own skins by testifying against their partners. Thus, we should be punishing the innocent, the honorable, with threats of prosecution for perjury, or with undeserved contempt sentences because they come to their honorable principles, while granting freedom to those who may truly be guilty of damaging the public interest. Is this the kind of law we really want? I don't think so. Finally, there is one immunity that neither this law nor any legislative act can give, and that is the immunity from misuse of its powers by men of ill will. That is why the founders of this nation zealously sought to limit the powers of lawmakers from granting unbridled powers to government agencies. We have come this far, and people like myself are able to testify at such a hearing as this today because of the guarantees which our Constitution provides. The protection of the right to silence is as important as the protection of the right to speech. It is intertwined with protection against invasion of privacy, limitations on free expression, free association, freedom to defend, freedom to criticize, and to change. Each limitation on these freedoms is a blow against the common good, against the public interest of free men in this free society, and indeed against the very society we wish to protect. And that's all I have to say. And so for all these reasons, I urge that you recuse yourself here now on this committee and go on record and address the public interest in this matter. And I would like to add, as you will note from the copies that I leave with you, that while I am responsible for the wording of the statement, it has been subscribed to by Allison Belcher, who is vice chairman of the Montgomery County Democratic Central Committee, Bill McCoy, who is chairman of the Montgomery County Democratic Central Committee, and John Callahan, who is chairman of the State and Federal Affairs Committee of the Montgomery County Democratic Central Committee. And I have been authorized by all three of them to present this statement on their behalf as well as on behalf of the
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. We will need a copy.
Yes.
Are there any questions? If not, thank you very much.
May I have one other thing? Thank you. I have been asked by some friends who were deeply concerned to leave with you a written statement with several of them have come from the list. It is obviously their own statement which they grew up on this one too. And I would simply like to leave that written statement to them.
Thank you very much. The next person that gets specified is Christopher Thomas.
My name is Christopher Thomas. I'm an attorney from Portland, and I'm appearing here on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union. I believe you all have copies of the statement that I'm about to read. And after I read the statement, I'll be happy to answer any questions. House Bill 1004 purports to grant immunity from prosecution to a witness who is compelled to testify in criminal, quasi-criminal, and grand jury proceedings. The American Civil Liberties Union opposes the bill because the state does not have the power to grant immunity from prosecution by the federal government or other states. The Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution, in particular, prevents the state from granting a witness immunity from federal prosecution. Furthermore, the American Civil Liberties Union feels that laws which compel self-incriminating testimony but do not grant immunity from all prosecution violate a witness's constitutional privilege against self-incrimination. If a witness is compelled to give self-incriminating testimony, it is inevitable that the giving of testimony will increase the likelihood of prosecution for the acts about which the witness testifies. The use of compelled testimony to increase the likelihood of prosecution violates the constitutional prohibition against the use of the truth of compelled testimony. The American Civil Liberties Union recognizes that the United States Supreme Court in Murphy versus Waterfront Commission may have refused to adopt this reasoning, but the union believes the reasoning should be considered. In addition to its general opposition to this type of legislation, the American Civil Liberties Union in particular opposes House Bill 1004 for several reasons. One, the caption, which refers only to witnesses before grand juries, is misleading. Two, the bill applies to witnesses in quasi-criminal proceedings. Quasi-criminal proceedings is a vague term with no known meaning. It could be construed to include various disciplinary proceedings. Legislation of this type should be drawn narrowly and carefully. Three, the bill grants to any court the power to compel testimony. This power should at least be limited to the circuit court, and a transcript should be made of all proceedings under the bill. Four, the bill expressly should grant a witness the right to counsel in any hearing held pursuant to the bill. Five, the bill grants the district attorney broad discretionary power and severely limits the court's power to review the district attorney's decision to compel testimony. The district attorney should be required to prove to the court that the compulsion of testimony will be in the public interest, and the court should have a broad discretion to refuse to compel testimony. And I should add at the end that any suggestions we make should not be construed as an endorsement of any type of bill which compels testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Question? Yes, Mr. Gill.
Are you saying that the state and federal government, which goes to become law, the total cat and mouse game that they put under investigation. We gathered immunity to testify for a grand jury, and that testimony could later be used in a federal proceeding to convict him.
No, I am not suggesting that. What I am saying is the bill, in section 2, says that the witness shall not be prosecuted for on account of any act about which is required to testify. This bill cannot prevent the federal government from prosecuting on account of the act. Under Murphy versus Waterfront Commission, has decided a bill properly, a bill could, the testimony could not be used. The testimony could not. A person could be independently convicted of the crime about which he testified. Now, this bill purports to prevent the person from prosecuting. The testimony can't be used by the federal government if it's compelled by the state, because that would be a violation of the 5th and 14th Amendment right against self-incrimination.
If they can use it for further investigation.
No, they cannot. The federal government would be forbidden to use the testimony or the proofs of the testimony. Now,
can they see the testimony?
Oh,
yes. Yeah. So would it be forbidden to develop other testimony?
Well, they can use it, yes, that's true. As a matter of fact, the difficulty, which I mentioned in my second paragraph, if you have a copy of the testimony, is that the federal government is not supposed to use the testimony to get leave, but there is it is virtually impossible for the witness to prevent the government from doing that and to show that the government in fact has done that.
Mm-hmm. And you say this particular reason was decided by the
That is correct, it was. We would like to have that re-examined, I assure you.
Yeah. You didn't mention the testimony in the
script.
You didn't mention the testimony on the Ninth Amendment right. The Ninth Amendment is, of course, getting developed in the Ninth Amendment. And we really don't know what kinds of rights are protected. Under the Ninth Amendment, it seems that you would be making the beginning to at least see that there is going to be some right of privacy that is protected by the Ninth Amendment. Would this, in your opinion, this kind of legislation violate this kind of right?
I did not bring that up. The ACLU in the past and still does take the position that even in the case of a total grant of immunity, this type of legislation forces a person to socially degrade himself by his own testimony. And for that reason, this type of legislation also is objectionable. That was one of the I don't know if the committee is aware that there, some time ago, was federal legislation in this area. That was one of the very strong ACLU objections to that legislation. In terms of privacy itself, I think that would have to be tied together with the fact that the person is being forced to disclose information about himself by his own testimony.
Would you assume that if your election event was passed, this would give rise to another round of litigation in the state of Oregon regarding the constitutionality of this particular proposal? It added expense to increase expertise at the case of examining these instances, whether the district committee has overreached itself on and so forth. So it was going to be a kind of huge bit of discussion, gratitude, issues, and stories, et cetera.
I certainly think that this would be attacked practically every time it was used. Certainly, yeah. And so there's an awful lot of pressure in this outlet that would be.
Ms. Hall?
I think I'm looking at this bill for the first time, and I have the same thoughts about the very policy of the bill. However, we have followed constitutional guarantees that are spelled out by the Constitution of the right to speech.
This is the type of question that comes up, I suppose, every time the United States Supreme Court has to go one step further in terms of individual rights, and I think that the question has to be every time, can you infringe or delete from the individual's rights, or should you, should the government be required to use independent methods, more scientific methods, to get convictions if they need to get convictions? The ACLU's position on this is that in this area, the individual rights must be respected. The government will have to use more sophisticated investigatory methods. I recognize the judgment factor, the judgment that you have to make, but it's our position on this that the person's rights in this area are supreme.
One other thing, just concerning the supporters of the bill say that it's still passed that the need of the testimony on the proof is that it could be utilized for such a prosecution. So that's a component of the common sense because how that works. I can see that they cannot use the platform itself. And I can see that they can say we can't use the platform that they receive. And we can try to go back and prove that that is a starting point. But doesn't the individual become a suspect or instantaneously? And then they can go about seeking independent evidence. And is there any protection there?
Frankly, there's none that I know of. The least that the bill does, if a person is compelled to say, I did whatever it is, the least that this bill does is it tells in other jurisdictions that this is the person. So they don't have to, they immediately stop investigating anybody else. And that seems self-apparent to me, that the other difficulty is how does the individual show that the government that now wants to prosecute them did not somewhere get a little help out of that testimony?
interest in more. And in regard, let's take a white collar crime, that's more prevalent. Conspiracy type of thing involving several states. Where we've done crimes, perhaps related to several jurisdictions. We just built it on a prosecution state in the state of California, state court there.
A prosecution in California? As far as I know, there's no way the state of Oregon can prevent California just by enacting the bill from prosecuting. Now, I don't know if there were an agreement between the state of Oregon and California, which were approved by the United States Congress as interstate agreements must be, then perhaps California would be prevented from prosecuting. Well, then California would be prevented from prosecuting. Independently, we could not stop that.
And the person could be prosecuted in the state of California based on the evidence.
Well, the evidence could not be used in California. Could not be used by the federal government.
No, I'm talking about the state of California.
It couldn't be used by the evidence could not be used.
Why would that have to be used?
Because the Constitution forbids the state of California to use testimony that was compelled, no matter who compelled it. If Oregon compels it, California still can't use that testimony. I'm not sure what you mean by indirect. They couldn't use it for criminal prosecution, but I suppose they might not even be able to use it for purposes, say, of refusing a license. That would be a question.
Mr. Thomas, you mentioned that the testimony could be socially degrading to the individual. Now, there's nothing to be degrading about testifying for a suit.
No.
Then the socially degrading portion would come from the person being required to admit that he was committed some act that has to be socially degrading.
That is correct. I think I see what you're driving at. The objectionable part of that is that the person is required to degrade himself. Certainly someone who, an independent witness who testifies in a criminal proceeding that the defendant did it, it is degrading the defendant. Well, I think you have to draw the distinction between that and requiring the defendant to, or the witness to degrade himself.
Well, the witness actually has degraded himself by doing whatever he's done, not by testifying about it. Is my point that he is adding that.
Well, he's not degraded until the incident. Well, I'm talking about social degradation, not the individual's own moral degradation. Socially, he doesn't become degraded until the information becomes public.
Any other questions?
Government having the power to compel you to talk about something you don't want to talk about, isn't that the issue?
Yes, I'm sorry, I did not see where you were going in your question before. That would be the area where you would be dealing purely with Ninth Amendment type privacy, really the government prying into the personal areas of the individual.
Okay. Other questions?
The federal statute is not like this one. It doesn't purport to grant immunity from prosecution by all jurisdictions. It merely provides that the testimony may not be used. Right. Now, the federal government does have the power to prevent prosecution by the states in all areas in which the federal government can compel testimony. It's our position, and I think it's pretty weak, although there's no case exactly on point, that the state cannot prevent prosecution, although the federal government can. That involves around the supremacy clause. Yes, I think there are about 40 that have been.
We have the federal government having a plan to do it, but
yeah,
have 40 states having a plan to do it.
That is correct. That they're not, we object and oppose all of them. And as I said, in particular, we oppose this one for the five or six reasons I outlined, and also the reasons it purports to give immunity to us. Thank you.
it would not be honored with that. So I think really the only difference in criminal cases is contempt cases. Somebody mentioned the expense of appeal to test this out. First, there wouldn't be additional expense of appeal in terms of the defendant who is being tried, because he has nothing to complain about. All he has to complain about is that a witness is compelled to tell the truth. On the other hand, we have a case up right now pending in front of the Court of Appeals where the defendant is complaining that the court allowed one of his defense witnesses to claim the fifth, and therefore he was denied process, unable to use a witness. So I don't think we're going to get, I think what we will have is one appeal contested out from somebody who protests that he was compelled to tell the truth. There was talk about citizens' right to silence. There isn't such a thing. There is a right against self-incrimination. There was some talk, particularly from Representative Skelton, about presuming the guilt. The reason you must grant immunity to a witness in this situation is not because you presume guilt, but because he himself said, I will not testify because if I tell the truth, it will tend to incriminate me. So what you're saying is to him. No, him. He has no, a judge will not honor the claim that it was coming from somebody else. There's no similar. So if he claims I refuse to testify because it will tend to incriminate me, you're not saying you're guilty, buddy. You're saying you need to not worry about incriminating yourself because we can't charge you. Mr. Thomas recognized that Murphy versus Waterfront is Tonka, and I took the liberty of expanding what I said earlier in the week by sending a letter with the summary conclusion quoted from that case to the committee. There is not an invasion of privacy any more than any other witness who may come forward and testify about unpleasant details in his life. In his life. No, there's another privilege to deal with that particular problem, and the ACLU argues against this method of obtaining testimony. It's the same argument it uses against virtually every other method, sometimes with much validity, sometimes not, that the government should rely upon other methods of gaining convictions, on more sophisticated laboratory techniques and other investigative devices. But, you know, there are only so many cases you can solve in a lab. And you just can't say, well, confessions are no good, you should look to other evidence. Searches are no good, you should look to other evidence. This is no good, that's no good, and something else is no good. Identification evidence is no good, you should go somewhere else. Yeah. There's got to be something, yes, but still a good kind of evidence to use. And probably the best kind of evidence is what people say under oath. And that's what we're saying. We're saying to witnesses under oath. It doesn't affect them in the interrogation room or anything like that. It's in court under the protection of the judge, and there's no problem. I think that's
about all. So, just 1 second, and I think somebody over here has made enough news. Yes. Or is
anyone? What part of that?
What does it not cover?
I mean, thinking of pretty
well, all I can think of that it would cover would be contempt of fear.
How about? Well, I'm concerned. That would also take the culinary and the domestic relations to go from the
right. If you're in a criminal contempt situation,
yeah. How about affiliation?
I'm not aware that those are considered played by criminals.
I think
the old question.
I was wondering about this bond
and ultimately wound up in the court. And the penalty is, if he follows that order, that he will be compelled to tell the truth as a witness. You know? None of this. What I'm saying is, you have to gauge the degree of process into a court to the magnitude of the results that are going to occur. You get muffled down with procedure and not very large issues. Other times, you expect great gravity and you have to have very cautious answers. But we're talking about whether it's always an answer question or being during the trial and many other things depending upon the immediate decision. So I would think that summary proceeding gives the judge his freedom to exercise discretion and tailor the procedure to the magnitude of the situation.
They have withdrawn and taken any criminal proceedings with a witness who did testify. Okay.
On the ground, they didn't have any criminal.
You get a trial. The witness is on the stand. Jury in the bar. The witness is asked questions. He says, I refuse to ask questions. The judge, the citizen, says, Your Honor, under the statute of prisons of law, I think the question is on the court. I ask that you require the prison to ask me. The jury just said,
Well, jury did excuse the court, but essentially, everybody else did. Because that's a legal matter that they have no interest in.
Well, but they're going to do it in the beginning of it.
They have plain privilege,
yeah.
Excuse me, I want to say in addition, I'm held in Oregon that if the district attorney, and I would think the other side too, calls a witness knowing that witness is going to take the fifth, but having good reason to allow them to do that in front of the jury, that's grounds for mistrial. Not to grant a mistrial in that situation, it's worth my error. But where a prosecutor does have some indication of how he's going to take the fifth, even that's not that bad.
Have you ever read the book, The Lion and the Throne, by Captain Mitchell Bowen? The story is Lord Cook and the development of the Fifth Amendment right to be over 23 feet. Which the judges tell Mitchell Bowen. What happens to the Fifth Amendment when we pass an election?
It remains in fact and firm.
Yes. But you may still punish the person for claiming the Fifth Amendment right.
No.
Yes, you
may. You may punish the person for not testifying in a situation which is not intimidating. Which you and I must do.
Well, that's but isn't it true, though, that under this provision, the Fifth Amendment holds the Fifth Amendment and does not want to testify, and when he's offered the privilege to testify, he must either testify or he will be punished for failing to testify. Isn't that right?
Yes, it would be.
Okay, how different is that then from being put on the rack?
Well, I think
simply because we're not putting him on the rack and we're putting him in jail for contempt, what's the difference between those two?
I'll tell you what the difference is. At one time, you wish to convict. The Fifth Amendment was designed to cure the situation wherein the government convicted people out of their own mouth. This provides that you may eliminate the possibility of conviction. In fact, immunity and does not allow you to convict him out of his own mouth, because there is nothing left to convict him of. You're not punishing him for his claim of protection against self-incrimination anymore, because that claim no longer exists once immunity is granted. You are then punishing him for refusing to do that which everybody else must do, and that's testify, even where, as in many other situations, such as, for example, a rape victim, the details of the testimony are extremely unpleasant.
I haven't thought about JC, I was thinking about district court.
And I just couldn't think of a particularly good distinction. Reason to deny the district court the same power unless in court in front. Perhaps we might say it's not a court of record, and therefore perhaps protection accorded might not be maybe more lax. Whether that's sufficient or not to deny the district court, that's our point of view.
Thank you, Mr. Kendrick. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 1004? Alright. Not. Close the hearing. Thank you very much for coming.
Paragraph two, whatever.
that part which allows an appeal from an order granting the defendant's motion for judgment of acquittal, and also by striking the proposed amendment against the
standard. Well, it's not in yet.
It's not in.
No.
I've
heard Mr. Stokes' motion is in discussion.
Yeah, and what you want to do is restore the original language and the ballot. You want others, you want to delete the granting defense motion for judgment of acquittal procedure RS 126605 and restore on line 8 the same appeal form of conviction of acquittal. The present statute.
So I understand your motion, Mr. Stokes, you want to allow them to eliminate the language from line 6 and go with the language on line 7. So,
No.
I think you started with line 9 and 10.
Yeah, 8, 9, 10.
I think the motion could read the instructions on line 9 and 10.
Taking out the brackets
on line 8.
Oh,
that's correct.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, that's your motion.
That is my motion.
Mr. Stokes moves that lines 9 and 10 be deleted from House Bill 1003. That's a former language of the statute on line 18 is stored. That's correct. Present language.
Yes.
Okay. Any further discussion? Questions been called for? All those in favor of the amendment? Grant the aye. The name is called. Those opposed, no. Please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Questions been called for. All those in favor will answer aye. The name is called. Those opposed, no. Please call the roll.
Aye.
No. Aye. I was thinking about that.
He wants to carry 10-04.
10-04.
I want him to.
Bob, are you carried?
Yes.
All right. Did you? I haven't signed one for you already, have I?
No, I don't think so. If you have, I missed it.
Yeah. How about 1097, subcommittee number two, ready to report on that one again. I see it's been reverted. He passed the amendment. Also, 1097. Explain why.
George Brown, okay, Mr.
Marvin, are you there?
I guess
you want to explain it? What's where we are?
The building. All the buildings. Hopefully, you know, back then. When the administration makes an error in the kingdom, they're only if they crank out a mistake and they overpay the fellow who receives benefits, then the bill allows them. The administration to deduct from the amount that you should receive in that particular year. And the bill goes on further to have an additional or a subsequent 52-week period in which they deduct the amount that they overpaid the man. They deduct that from the amount you should receive. One of the things we have to
What about the cause of action that we were at the
second point? In addition to this, deducting the amount, they cannot be a bringing that from the law to recover the amount.
You don't know if somebody wrote this question about it, what the issue about the 15-19.
Well, we didn't ask them to know that. That was confusing. After this, I posed the answer to the question that the statute means that you can't pay benefits, or there's a mistaken benefit. So Tom Young and I decided that meant that you could be machine if you have a $10,000 check. That you could recover that because those aren't benefits. What this is talking about is, I wish it could be as much when he stated if a machine makes a mistaken amount. That's not really what they're, what, how the mistake arises. It's when John D. Doe is entitled to benefits and the benefits go to John C. Doe. Which is, he's really not designed to take care of or to preclude mechanical errors. You know, instead of a $10 check, they're not envisioning spending out a $1,000 check. This is when you're paying benefits to it. The person's benefits should have been cut off. He still gets the right amount of money in the check. He just didn't be getting it at all. So we concluded that since the statute is written, the same benefits, that if the check came out $10 million instead of $10, you're not precluded because it's not benefit.
So we're guessing in the interpretation of statute. Well,
that's our Supreme Court.
That's a good guess. It says if any error, always because of any error, not his own fault, the state is benefit from the chapter any amount to which he's not entitled. $20 and they're going to be $200.
this goes cut there, I don't think that's what he's still talking about.
The reserve is down.
I had a question.
Very cool.
I've been a young raiser to what was from an effect of a different statute, a subsequent provision in the law that you found last time from after that.
I did.
Yeah, I know it was
early. It was a previous statute, but I don't know.
Hold on. This is 7.3. The one you do it. Not being allowed to file an action for recovery.
Mm-hmm.
There's another statute that says they can file an action at law only when the fellow makes a false misrepresentation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still law. I'm still bothered about this. I mean, if you sit around here and interpret that, you know, it doesn't apply to clerical mistake. But can't we actually do a better drafting job and say that?
Well, we asked him that question. And
he said it was not the case.
He said never the same.
Just 100.
This is very smart and odd. No one.
Am I on
I'm sure every member has amended. I'm sure
every member disagrees with the whole statute, but that's existing law. The only thing is an additional 52-week period after the benefit year. And we can do that.
We've got that change to a model of my report, and then they see that $100.
We move that to, it used to be payments in excess of $100, now it should be a $10. They deleted the language in excess of $100 in line 14. There's two things. Is that one?
I'd like to increase the increase, but the more that I said, I'd like to hear about the whole thing, but in the administrative maybe it's created. Apparently, the odds of it do have them all the time.
What do we do with it?
What's the purpose of this?
Is that a book?
Them to write off ones that they've had sitting around for a long time?
Put them on? That was the one. That's the one where they use the warrant levy to collect the.
This is the one. This is the one.
Oh, it is the one.
Anytime Mr. Nordback talks to me about it, I decide to vote for it and I can see using it. But every time you even hear, I don't feel like that. And it seems to me that the law could be drafted so that it would give the auditors or the director, whoever is doing this, the option to write it off after a period of years so that they're not stuck with paying it on the books for a period of years.
That's what they try to do with the language that
it is. It is.
We're all having trouble. We're sitting on the floor and we're going to have
50 people left the number here also had to cover it.
Not the way that that's appropriate.
This thing to me is that paragraph would be written so much better, and I'm sure I understand it. I see their need for it, and I think that I'd like to help them out in that respect administratively. But I think we're just trying to stop, we're just putting a band-aid on a band-aid and compounding it. Well, I think that would be.
Let's rewrite it.
Okay, we'll rewrite it.
And last time, that's all.
Yeah.
Nor actually write it.
I don't want to do that much people on the side of
the deal. Well, let's start like rewrite the whole thing.
How can you get that 14 line done?
1097 is re-referred to the subcommittee of the okay. Now, on some, oh, I got a few bills here that the bar wants to reduce. I'll go over with you.
There's another one back.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't have it on now.
Didn't we come over to you now, Bill?
Oh, well, we did now, Bill.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, 1128.
Right.
1128.
I mean, I'm important, but here it is. Okay. Well, hold on after a while. This one is at the request of the Committee on Criminal Law and Procedure of the Oregon State Bar. Amend the Constitution to permit criminal charges and search the court upon information filed by the district attorney. Amend the Constitution to permit criminal charges and search the court upon information filed by the district attorney. Representative Cole moves that we introduce the bill as a committee bill. We request the Oregon State Bar. Is there any objection? Not so ordered. Here's one at the request of the Committee on Criminal Law and Procedure of the Oregon State Bar. Provides that the court may determine whether defendants or offenses be tried separately. I vote against that as myself, but I. How about it? You want to introduce it? President Skelton moves that we introduce that as a committee bill. Any objection? So ordered.
Not to the introduction.
There is one that retains personal jurisdiction and domestic relations suit. Retains personal jurisdiction and domestic relations suit over Oregon while Oregon has left the state, provided Oregon has a place of marital domicile for at least 6 months. And suit is brought within 6 months after departure and personal services made. Continues jurisdiction when Oregon is marital domicile over court rights of Oregon residents. When no appearance is made in the domestic relations suit in another jurisdiction and personal services made on other party in Oregon.
Sounds like a boss business.
At the request of the Committee on Family and Juvenile Law of the Oregon State Bar.
Can we pass a law to defend their jurisdiction? Beyond the state verdict?
The border to border, continental. Any objection? Representative Shelton moves. Don't everybody run off because we got another matter. This is at the Committee on Judiciary to request the Committee on Property of the Oregon State Bar, which permits an association of unit owners of condominiums to be nonprofit corporations and add insurance requirements when an association forms such a corporation. Any objection? Ben Schultz moves. No objection. So ordered. This is at the request of the Real Property Committee of the Oregon State Bar. Permits development of condominiums in stages.
Don't ask.
Yeah, I probably. Yeah. Anybody want to move? Well, if there's no objection, I guess nobody has to move. In the past, Marvin, Harold, remember, and there was a rule that was a standing rule as part of the thing, which he took out, that we would introduce automatically any bar bills, you know, just sort of put them in as a favor to. I don't know
a bar bill is good in the
bar. Yeah, they haven't had very good success, frankly. Here's one of the requests of the Family and Juvenile Law of the Oregon State Bar. Permits the responding court to order an investigation of financial circumstances of the person seeking reciprocal enforcement of the support order. Permits temporary support for up to 90 days pending receipt of the report. Authorizes use of report as evidence and allows dismissal of the proceedings when the report is not furnished. Any objection? The answer. This one is at the request of the Family and Juvenile Law Committee of the Oregon State Bar. Ends adversary nature and title of domestic relationships. Extends protection for welfare of minor children's marriage, including provisions for court supervised trust to property set apart for their benefit during the minority. Establishes irreconcilable differences
which have caused the irremediable breakdown of. Breakdown of the marriage as the primary ground for ending marriage. Eliminates fault and discrimination of issues, shortens residence and waiting weeks period, substitutes reasonable support around 1 to 2 weeks waiting period. Are we in the market now?
I
only
carry about 6 days.
That's terrific. Is there any residency? What's the residency? Oh. Is there any objection? Okay.
This time, I am told,
Senator Grinstead, who is the head of the Criminal Law Revision Committee in the Senate, and in order to expedite the hearings on the new proposed criminal code, he's suggesting that we might, could you get one more? We might possibly hold joint hearings, but he's already prepared. Can you get one off? Prepared to schedule hearing dates. And I told him that my offhand, thought would be that about 3 members of this committee be appointed to sit with them, with all members of this committee being notified of every time there's a hearing over there, but have 3 people maybe assigned to go to these things. Now, you can see already we've got a conflict because we meet Tuesdays at 1 p.m. and Wednesdays at 3 p.m. with maybe a conflict. First of all, let me ask if anybody wants to tackle this thing. Harold was on the committee. Tom was on it. Might be good for someone who has no familiarity at all with it.
Like the third.
Yeah, we're doing it too.
I'd take around that.
I'd like to do this. All right. Put the number. Well, there's my committee right there. Now, how is your time schedule? So you better take a look at that.
Real bad. Normally. Everything that I have normally, I've got 6 games in this game.
Which means when?
6 o'clock in the winter. Well, we don't know for sure.
We don't know yet.
The only time we're going to come to the subcommittee with Tuesday, which is 1 o'clock in the evening.
I just normally be there on the energy on the third hour of the year.
You'll get noticed, Steve.
Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Monday, Friday.
What time?
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock.
Yeah, so that's a
couple of minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Figure on something that's too much. Can you look it out, Keith, so that maybe you can use one of our regular meetings and substitute if you need an extra hearing time?
You know, that hearing schedule.
What we could do for a while afterwards is try to have this meeting at 8 o'clock.
Monday, Wednesday, and then Friday. Say Friday for a close meeting?
Yeah. Well,
use any one of those days you want. But try to say Friday so we can. Mm-hmm.
Well, I would do well, I would assume that the customer would meet at 8 o'clock Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for 1 hour. Not regular.
All right.
9 o'clock.
Well, if you can work it out, if you can't, let Jenna know. I'll point to all his work and talk and stuff to meet with the Senate Criminal Law and Speaking Committee. And sitting joint session with us for the hearing, and the rest of us will be notified of these things and go on.
But
saw the next meeting on the 9th of May on Wednesday at 8:00.
Well done.